This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the podcast, the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Amplifies the voices of marginalized communities, amplifies survivors that the mainstream media neglects to share. And I am so excited to be here with one of my co-founders, Gwen. Gwen, hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so honored to be here as always. And yeah, we have a fantastic guest today, don't we?
Oh, yes, we absolutely do. This is somebody that has inspired me beyond belief, has been following the movement, amplifying the movement, collaborating with the movement, is an all-around badass human being. Ray, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you so much. Hi, everyone. My name is Ray Epstein, and I am a survivor, and I'm currently located in Colorado.
Yes, absolutely. Welcome to the podcast, everybody, and we are so excited to have Ray join us today. I do want to give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. We will be talking about sexual abuse. We'll be talking about sexual assault. We will be talking about current litigation and current legislation that is being discussed and being amplified. Part of our mission as the Rise of Justice Movement is to amplify the stories of survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, sexual assault, domestic violence, gun violence, trafficking, you name it. We are on a mission to share the voices and to share the stories that do not reach the headlines. So Ray, without further ado, again, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Please walk us through your journey, where you were, where you are now, and what's in the future for you.
Thank you so much again for such a nice introduction, and I'm so happy to be here. I think I'll go back to the beginning of how I got into this work. So when I was in middle school, I had grown up in Washington, D.C., and I attended a private school where I was definitely not one of the richer kids in my class. It was a very elite school in Washington, D.C. that was pre-K through eighth grade. So you kind of know the same people from about 2 years old until 14. But what was unique about this school and this educational experience is that the middle school was brand new. And so my experience as a middle schooler, I was one of the first cohorts to enter that space. And kind of along with students being the first people to enter that space, teachers were too, and administrators were too, people who had backgrounds and training that was limited to elementary education were suddenly in a space where puberty was changing bodies, changing emotions, changing hormones, changing dynamics, and the ways we interacted with each other, and they didn't know how to handle it. And so I think that uniquely kind of set up my own self and my own situation to fail in a way, because these people were just so ill-equipped to handle anything. Although many other schools also handle sexual violence, obviously, so poorly, I think these people didn't even anticipate it as a possibility. And so they were kind of just responding as it came up and as problems arose that they couldn't even imagine would come up because they just had no background. But when I was in seventh grade, someone transferred into my middle school, and that was really exciting for everyone because we'd all known each other since we were, again, like 2 years old. And we had about 20, 25 kids in our class. So, really, really small group of people and a really small bubble. We didn't really interact with people outside of our school because there were so many events and so many community gatherings that really brought us together within this bubble and cemented this small community. So, when someone new entered, it felt like this exciting possibility for everyone. And I immediately developed a crush on him. And on a school trip, he told me he liked me. And a relationship kind of blossomed really quickly from there, as middle schoolers tend to skip, the every step and just define a relationship immediately, or younger people who don't know how relationships are supposed to kind of unfold, getting to know each other. And it got dark pretty quickly. I had no sex education besides how babies were conceived traditionally. And it was completely limited to that. So I didn't know much about consent. I didn't know what was supposed to come before sex, what could come before sex, that sex was even on the table in middle school or something people thought about. That wasn't something I was aware of at all. I don't think it's common necessarily, maybe more so as generations are having more access to the internet. But over the course of our relationship, I started getting pushed and pushed and pushed into doing things that I was completely uncomfortable with. It was very coercive. I would say no. He would just move my hand to places that I didn't want my hands to be. Every time I'd pull it away, he'd put it back. There were many small instances that escalated into bigger things. When he came to my house one day, he sexually assaulted me much more severely than the smaller things. And I was just so confused because I had no idea what was happening. I didn't even understand really what was wrong about the situation, but that something was wrong and that I felt terrible about it. This was right before summer started. And I finally, over the summer, with some distance from him, not seeing him every day, felt like I could break up with him without the risk of he would threaten suicide throughout our relationship, saying, no one will ever love you. I'm going to kill myself if you don't love me, if you don't stay with me. And I had really believed him and really been scared that he would follow through on that and felt really trapped. But I finally couldn't take being with him anymore. And I think summer gave me the strength to end that relationship. And he immediately, when I broke up with him, sent me a picture of a bottle of pills in his hand, saying this was my fault, that now he was going to die. And my mom called his mom. I finally told my mom what was happening. And she said, oh, he's playing board games with us. And I really slowly started to realize my relationship had been so full of so many manipulative lies to get me to pity and play along with everything that he wanted me to do. And in a way, I'm a bit sympathetic because he was also a child. Which complicates things. And so I sympathize a bit because I imagine he was recreating behavior that he saw at home himself because we were only 13. But right before school started again in 8th grade, he sent me a death threat, and that I knew was wrong and I knew was scary. And I knew that was something that I was supposed to tell an adult about versus sexual assault. I really didn't understand. And so I told my mom, we showed it to my principal. He said, he's just joking around, probably. He had said, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you. But my principal said he was joking around. And they told me they could only separate us for non-skills-based classes because of the nature of how small our class sizes were. So in Spanish class, we were still together. In some other classes, we were still together. And alphabetically by last name, we were right next to each other, sharing a table. And I remember the second that I saw him again when 8th grade started, I just physically collapsed because I think the weight of everything that had happened finally hit me and finally registered as not only was his death threat something that was upsetting and wrong, but everything else was so violating leading up to that. And I ultimately reported those instances to my school, and I was just met with complete and utter disbelief. So I really am passionate now today about talking about institutional betrayal, recognizing why it happens, and trying to understand why we don't inherently and instinctively believe survivors, especially children, who can't even know what it is that people are accusing them of making up, when they're just relaying the behavior that they witness without even having the language to label it. And so that's really where I am today, long story short.
Ray, thank you so much for sharing your story. And unfortunately, as we all know, it's much more common than everybody may think. And I'm also a survivor of childhood sexual assault. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. And I've noticed more celebrities and people in the public eye talking more about assault that's happened to them as children, and how it affects them and their development. And I know there's, Keke Palmer has talked about being sexually assaulted by other children. And I think it's something that is also not talked about because, as you said, your principal was like, oh, well, they're just joking, you kind of threatening to kill you and things like this, and after assaulting you. And that's happened to me as well. So I kind of want to ask you, as a child, how do you feel how do you feel the assault affected your development and overall quality of life growing into womanhood? And do you feel like there are resources that were given to you earlier, or if you had resources given to you earlier that maybe things would have, your life, quality of life, I would say, would have turned out differently, if that makes sense. If you don't mind speaking a little bit about that.
And Ray, really
Definitely.
quickly, can I jump in just for a second? I just wanted to say, because a lot of the talk around like boys will be boys or kids are being kids, it's oftentimes it's swept under that rug, and kind of like going into like what Gwen was talking about. Gwen, I think that's kind of what you were getting at, is like that boys will
Yes.
be boys and like that predatory system of setting, future generations up for failure.
Yes.
Because we know that whenever a system fails a child, we all fail. And it's on, it starts at home a lot of the times. And Ray, you speak very eloquently, and I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to add that directly in and say, that thought of boys will be boys and, oh, they're just doing this and they're just doing that for attention and blah, blah, blah. I understand that, right? But what's your thoughts? So going back to Gwen's question, walk us through that. Walk us through your thoughts with that question, and then we'll kind of jump into like that boys will be boys, and I put that in parentheses. You can't see it, but I put it in parentheses because it's important to talk about.
Definitely, it's a good conversation to have. And Gwen, your question totally makes sense. I think I'll start with the latter end of your question, which is what resources did I receive? And I received completely nothing. My principal or the head of school, my school was structured kind of uniquely because of how the middle school was underneath overall head of school with the elementary school and the preschool. So we had a principal that was kind of this overarching person at the top of the pyramid, and then different heads of school, depending on if it was preschool, elementary school, or middle school. The head of middle school, I should also clarify, was a really old close friend of my family, just by the fact I had an older brother who had attended the school. I had cousins who had attended the school. So he was the science teacher before he was the head of school. He was very close with my family because he was also my neighbor. And so this man knew me for most of my life, but instantly didn't believe me over someone who had just transferred to our school, who had been previously, according to my abuser, I don't know if this is accurate because he lied so much, but had been expelled from his past school for fighting people with a knife. And I'm not surprised by that because he did have a knife, and his mother is a very, very powerful person in the Republican Party, who I think can make a lot of things go away. And I also think that factored into how I was treated because this was a person with a lot of money, and a lot of power and a lot of PR experience. And so I was immediately sent to the guidance counselor's office, is the only resource I received. But when I went to the guidance counselor's office, she sat me down for a conversation about consent. And she asked me if I knew what consent was. And I answered that yes, like I knew the general definition of consent meant, you're agreeing to something or you're not. If you're not, someone's violating you. In theory, I understood consent. In practice, it was more confusing when I was experiencing a violation of it, but I did understand it to that extent. And she said, well, he was your boyfriend, right? Did you ever hold his hand? And I said, yeah, of course, he was my boyfriend. And she said, well, did you ask him every time you held his hand? And I said, no, he's my boyfriend. We held hands sometimes. He didn't ask either. And she said, well, he could easily say you sexually assaulted him. And so you should be careful what you accuse people of. And immediately my mind just started swimming because now I'm thinking, as this 13-year-old who has no understanding of what happened to me, I just knew something was wrong, that I've done something terrible. And I think that really formulated the way that I believed myself, experienced healing or lack thereof, and perceived my own experience for so many years. Because I was disbelieved by a family friend and neighbor who I thought trusted me. And then suddenly I was being accused of sexual assault for holding my boyfriend's hand. And I thought, if I feel like this after what happened to me, I can't imagine that I made someone else feel like this. Like there's a possibility that he's out there feeling this way because of me is the message that was sent to me. I was sent home from school. I had to talk to my mom. She didn't know the extent of what had been going on beyond the death threats. And me and her talked, and I feel incredibly lucky because my mom is really the only resource I had. My mom is an attorney who helps women for pro bono receive civil protection orders or civic protection orders in DC. So helps them get restraining orders. So she's very knowledgeable in this area, although it wasn't something I was necessarily at 13 very passionate about that we had a lot of discussions about. She immediately knew a lot about the system, a lot more than I did. She knew about institutional betrayal and she recognized it happening and explained what was happening to me. Although I think by that point it was too late to really reverse the damage that had been done in my mind, amidst all of this confusion, amidst all these feelings that I had kept inside for so many months after my assault had taken place, where I was just kind of wondering and making my own narrative in my head about self-blame and self-doubt and shame. But my mom knew that the court system failed survivors so regularly that it would probably not be a good or worthwhile experience for me, especially with how much doubt I think she saw me already expressing in myself after the conversation I had with my guidance counselor and with my principal. And she had considered court. I didn't really feel like I was part of that conversation or asked necessarily, which is something I have mixed feelings about because I was a child, because I was so young. Yes, agency and autonomy are important, but also, can we really make informed decisions at that age? And so I feel lucky to have had an advocate who was knowledgeable, who had my best interests, who knew me. But I also had an advocate who was very protective and more so probably above anything was protective of me because she was my mom. And so I always wonder if maybe it would have worked out if I had gotten the opportunity to pursue legal action, if it would have traumatized me further. I'm definitely not resentful about it because I imagine it would have been the latter and traumatized me further. But there were several points where she did consider legal action because my abuser was threatening to release nude photos of me to my class in retaliation, that he had somehow, I think, taken a picture of from Snapchat on a different device. He was threatening me consistently through other students, sending Snapchats to my phone because I had blocked him on everything, just saying that I was like a stupid bitch, saying all of these things to me. And so there were points where my mom considered legal action, but it never really amounted to anything because I think she was watching just actively how I was falling apart from the retaliation by my school and by my peers who also disbelieved me because they liked this student who was new and intriguing and exciting versus me who had always never really fit in because I was from basically birth openly queer, and just a little bit ostracized growing up and never really fit in with this group of very, very, very rich, privileged children who were, for the most part, cis and hetero, at least at the time that I knew them. I don't talk to most of them anymore. But yeah, I didn't really receive any resources at all. And I think it had a really devastating impact on my life. And it took a really long time for me to rebuild to a place where I trust myself even half as much as I did when I was this self-assured little kid before. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, actually, and that in it's hard to know who you were before you were assaulted when you were assaulted as a child because you were still becoming the person you would be. But I know that I was really self-assured about everything that I believed. I was someone who had strong opinions. I was someone who trusted my gut and my instinct. And I really believe that I was becoming an independent, strong person who wasn't really afraid of saying things that made me not fit in. I think probably mostly because of how I had adjusted to being queer in this group of really heteronormative students who didn't love that I was queer. And I saw myself really change and curl back up after I reported. And it wasn't, after I assaulted that that started to happen. It was after I reported. And I think that really speaks to how we can put people back together if we do it correctly, if we support them in the aftermath. I really think the chances of them being built back up into the person that they were supposed to be becoming are so much higher. But if we meet them with lack of support, if we knock them down, if we disbelieve them, they just shrivel. And I think I watched that happen with myself. I didn't trust myself. I still don't sometimes. Like, I spend the end of my days writing down everything that I did that day because otherwise I'm scared I'll forget something. And if I'm interrogated about the details of that specific thing, like what I had for breakfast, someone will not believe other things I have to say. And that's something that I'm working on, but it's been a decade now. I'm turning 23 in 2 days, and I was 13 then. And it really, really deeply impacted me.
Well, I think Ray, you're one of the first people I've talked to that has also been sexually assaulted as a child. And I know there's many survivors that follow us that this has happened to you. And I think this is such an important conversation to have because, I'm 30 and I'm just like now really fully getting this like help that I've needed to process what's happened. And everything you've said from, not being believed by adults, from, being threatened by your abuser who was also a child themselves. I mean, it really hits home. And I think that this is going to help a lot of people because it does, you almost get frozen at the time when you're assaulted. And for me, it started when I was six. And, but it also happened when I was, around 13, when, you're talking about being assaulted and then so on and so forth. And it's just, wanting to break these cycles. And I totally understand that not being able to trust yourself. And in an age too, and you grew up in an age where you probably always had social media and a phone and hearing how an abuser could, had your abuser had threatened to leak your nudes and you're in middle school, that's just very, I know for me and Zachary, like our generation, obviously, I think Facebook came along when we were in middle school. So we were one of the first generations to have that. But, in MySpace and everything like that. But, the idea that, someone could do that when you're that young is very alarming. I know that there's a lot of children that will be exposed to things like this and are being exposed right now, like your story. So thank you so much for sharing this. And I just think it's going to help a lot of people, myself included. And with that, I want to pass to Zachary because I know he has a question for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Ray, thank you so much for speaking very candidly about, these hard-hitting topics, because this obviously is not easy to talk about, right? And every time that a survivor shares their stories, we feel Gwen, I'm going to tie in lighter, but Gwen wrote a song that is called Lighter, and it talks about, like the journey that a survivor goes through. And I want to jump really quickly. You know, you just graduated, right?
Yes.
And you founded an organization on campus to help other survivors feel less alone, gain those leadership skills, you know, and better equipped to handle what comes directly towards them. Can you walk me through what it was like being on campus? You know, walk us through the journey of being a founder of this organization and kind of what led you to doing that? And did you also have a Title IX office?
Absolutely. So we did have a Title IX office on campus, which is kind of what led me to starting this organization. But when I arrived, I went to Temple University. When I arrived on campus as a freshman, I was kind of excited to escape these labels that had really followed me through my life in DC of liar, of accuser, of allegations. I really just wanted to be Ray. I had never gotten the chance to be that person outside of those labels. And so although I was committed to finding some outlet through advocacy work, because I had gotten involved in that after eighth grade when I had reported, and all the way through high school, I didn't want it to be the thing that people associated with me anymore, because I wanted the chance to become the person that I kind of felt like I never got to be and to explore that girl. But I needed an outlet still, because it had become really therapeutic for me to be involved in advocacy work and activism in anti-sexual violence work. And I had seen when I was browsing the school's website before I even moved onto campus that there was a club called Student Activists Against Sexual Assault. I'm like, perfect. I'll go sit in the back of all of their meetings. I won't even tell my roommates that I'm in this club. And I'll feel like I'm doing something, and I'll feel like I'm part of something. And I'll feel like I'm seen as a survivor, but also unseen by the rest of campus. But I circled the club fair during weeks of welcome when I got there, like four times, looking for this table for SASA, Student Activists Against Sexual Assault, seeing all of these other clubs, but not that one. And I thought, oh, maybe they just aren't tabling. So I emailed their advisor, who happens to be the Title IX coordinator, and she says, this club has been, defective or defunct for the last 4 years. And something about that just made me feel like I have to do something, because people need these spaces. If I had had a space like this in high school, where my abuser also ultimately ended up attending with me, and so that whole mess of liar, of all of these names, of these threats continued for those 4 years, if I had had a space where I could feel recognized, where I could feel seen, where it felt like we were having conversations that benefited and, kind of tore apart the toxic culture that was allowing for people to treat me that way and making them think that they were entitled and also, in the right and justified to be treating me that way, then I would have probably been a lot more okay than I was. And so it felt like I had to start something, but at the same time, while I was going through the process of starting this org, I still felt really private about it, because all of these people were getting to know me in these first few weeks, and it felt really good to be someone different. But I also didn't feel like myself in a way, even though I had thought, excluding this label of survivor of my experience would make me feel more like myself. I think it made me feel less like myself, because it had become such a crucial and significant part of my identity, for better or for worse. And so I didn't feel like me. But at the same time, I now felt like these people had gotten to know this version of me that I had presented. And so for the rest of freshman year, I'm kind of building this club without talking to anyone about it. And I'm just doing silent outreach to people that I think would be interested, but asking them to, keep it on the down low. Like, let's not talk about it until it's a thing. We don't know if it'll be a thing yet. And I really fell off after my freshman year, the summer before sophomore year, when the club would have been approved to begin. I thought, I can't do this. I can't be this girl again. What if people think I'm a liar? What if everyone somehow can see all of the things that happened to me and all of the things that people called me just by looking at me? I just thought that's how people would suddenly perceive me. And so over the summer, I kind of just made this decision, I'm not going to do this. And then the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial started, and I was working online that summer for the Network for Victim Recovery of DC. So still involved in this work, but privately. And since I was working online, I had so much free time, and I just was watching all of this hate and disbelief unravel online toward Amber Heard. And I was so reminded of the way that I was treated when I came forward. Although for her, obviously, it was on an international scale, but I was just so reminded and devastated for her. I don't think their relationship was perfect by any means, but the evidence points to her being sexually and domestically abused by this man really strongly, versus the logic that was presented by him was kind of this performative, he is, Jack Sparrow, he is someone you've always loved, and people fell for that. And that was really, really reminiscent of people, I think, falling for my abuser being this kind of charismatic, exciting, intriguing guy in my class that everyone wanted to like, versus me being this person people didn't want to root for. And I just knew I had to do something again. And so I emailed the school. I said, where do we start? I want to make sure we're registered to table. Like, this club has to be a thing. And so even though I had missed a deadline to register for the fall club fair, they let me still register late. And after I explained to them I was going through stuff, and our club started. And I am so glad that it did, and that I found my way back to it, because I feel like in actually hosting meetings and actually being an open survivor with people and watching how it comforted them rather than it vilified me was how I ultimately got back to myself and kind of figured out that it's okay for me to be defined by the issue that I care about, by the one that I'm passionate about. It's just not okay for me to be defined by it by someone else. But when I'm the one branding myself, when I am the one saying I'm a survivor, I'm taking back my power. And that's what that club felt like for me once it really got off the ground. And it was just such an amazing experience, and I miss it really deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for sharing that. And really quickly, I want to talk about or, kind of mention like two different things. So one, in 2023, the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics released the Criminal Victimization Report, which was released in September of 2024. And in that report, in 2023, the rate of violent victimization in the United States was 22.5 victimizations per 1,000 persons aged 12 or older, which was similar to the 2022 rate, 23.5 victim violent victimization includes rape and or sexual assault, robbery, aggravated assault, and simple assault. Thinking about what's happening now, I want to do a really quick highlight on Veronica's Voice, which is the case of Veronica Rodriguez. This is a case that I heard about initially a little while ago, and it was brought to my attention that we needed to amplify it a lot more as there are certain things that are getting ready to transpire within this case. For 2 long years, Veronica and her family have endured a relentless and costly legal fight to restore her voice and clear her name after she was wronged by the very system meant to protect her. Veronica bravely came forward to report her sexual assault in the military, but instead of finding justice, she was wrongfully arrested and charged with filing a false report and wiretapping by the Fort Indian Town Gap Police, which is in Pennsylvania. Her courage was met with disbelief and accusations, turning her from a victim into a suspect. What was already a deeply traumatic experience became an even greater nightmare, one that her family has struggled to navigate emotionally and financially. Over these 2 years, Veronica's family has endured immense stress, pouring thousands of dollars into fighting these baseless charges. Legal counsel, expert witnesses, and travel expenses have piled up, leaving her loved ones burdened with overwhelming debt. The financial strain has only added to the emotional toll this flawed investigation has taken on them all. The police dismissed her rape claim simply because it wasn't reported the night it happened, ignoring clear evidence, including audio recordings where she says no and proves the encounter was non-consensual. This is directly off of her GoFundMe. And I am utterly disgusted, but I'm not surprised that yet again the quote unquote justice system is working the way it was designed. And I wanted to highlight that, and I felt like it was very pertinent to talk about because something that we don't really highlight a lot is what happens in the military, right? And that, oftentimes it's like swept under the rug. I mean, look at Vanessa Guillen, right? And thinking about our friend Lakeidra Gwynn and what she has endured and what she's focused on, and thinking
Yes.
about, like hundreds of thousands of other survivors within the military. Ray, can you speak really quickly on your interaction with Veronica and, kind of talk about that case a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. That case first came across, or I first came across it when I was still in college. I think because I was in Pennsylvania, I just was on the algorithm on social media for Pennsylvania cases specifically. And I remember I saw the headline that a woman had been arrested for felony wiretapping after recording her sexual assault. And I was so dumbfounded because we live in a society that pressures victims to present more evidence beyond their word or just the basis of their allegations. And she did exactly what we tell people to do, and we tell people is, sufficient and supposed to sustain an allegation beyond word, which doesn't seem to work in this justice system. And she was punished for it. And she was tortured for it by the justice system over and over and over again. When she has clear evidence that it happened, it was so devastating. And I didn't get to interact with her until really recently, but I was introduced to her right before she was sentenced to 30 days in jail. And getting to hear her perspective, getting to hear how she feels about what she's been through, and about how this is not unique, that this is happening, even though it sounds so horrific and unlikely and almost unbelievable. It's something that happens all of the time, and it's something that institutions, especially police departments, are really, really frequently guilty of. And we see that in the Victim Suspect film by Ray De Leon, which is an amazing film, and Nancy Schwartzman, who also made Roll Red Roll, which is a great film also on sexual violence, about how there is this reversal of victimhood that is unique to sexual and domestic violence, where often when people report that they've experienced abuse or harm to authoritative figures, that figure will turn it on its head and say, well, it seems like you actually are the person who's guilty of something here, whether it's that person taking money for a cab ride home after being sexually assaulted because they have no money, because they're missing their clothes, because they went home with this person and thought they'd get a ride home, but they were violated. That's an example from the Victim Suspect film. They were then charged with robbery for stealing $3. It is outrageous and much more common than we think. And I think Veronica's story has particularly been so misrepresented in media. And it's another kind of example that's, reminiscent of the Depp Heard trial to me, that a lot of media have capitalized on the headline of her being arrested for felony wiretapping, and they have started slandering her and leaning into this narrative that she is this vindictive woman trying to take down a married man who has a family. Every rape myth possible has been used in this case in every headline that I have seen. And I haven't seen one headline in the news, in the mainstream media, that is supportive of her. And again, I think it's like very reminiscent of that trial where mainstream media just refuses to combat those stereotypes. And you see other media platforms that are much larger that remain silent, and they would have the power to combat that narrative. They would have the power to overturn that narrative and to push against it. Like if the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote one story about Veronica Rodriguez, we probably wouldn't be where we are. But instead, they let all of these small conservative news outlets speak for her and speak against her and define this narrative. And so there's a public outcry then and a demand for her to be held accountable for something that is absolutely ridiculous versus holding her rapist accountable. But people don't pay attention to cases, they don't pay attention to the news. And so everyday people who aren't experts on sexual violence and have grown up being fed rape myths are seeing only headlines that somebody lied and that somebody is, out to get a man who is of high rank and supposedly successful, and nobody is pushing back against that narrative in a way that they're going to be able to access, then that's what they're going to believe. And so it's going to require action against her versus holding her rapist accountable.
Absolutely. I entirely agree with you stating exactly what you stated. And the mainstream media is complicit in silence. We know that, which is why our movement exists, which is why this podcast exists, because we're highlighting the stories that do not reach those headlines, that does not get the national attention and, create that conversation. One other case, and we'll jump into what you're currently working on, because this is deeply inspiring to me. One other case that I want to highlight is the case in Fairfax County with the Fairfax County School Board. And Gwen, I know this is also your home school district. A 26-year-old survivor is being asked to pay $250,000 in court costs after losing a Title IX case. Her appeal is still pending, but Fairfax County School Board wants to make an example of her. On September 19th, 2025, at 10 a.m., there was a meeting, right? And essentially, in 2011, Kate, a 12-year-old student at Rachel Carson Middle School, was repeatedly sexually assaulted by older youth, even though her main assailant had a known history of misconduct, including exposing himself in class just months earlier. School officials ignored Kate's pleas, covered up what happened, and punished her. Despite a positive rape kit, a police report, and formal complaints to the superintendent, Kate was placed on homebound instruction. The perpetrator faced no real consequences. Her family was forced to leave the state. More than a decade later, Kate still carries the emotional and physical injuries of what she endured in middle school. So, whenever you're talking about the Title IX office, you're talking about campus safety, you're talking about organizing. What's your reaction to this specific case with a court potentially criminalizing further a survivor and forcing her to pay $250,000 in discretionary court costs? And it leaves that question of why?
I think what's happening to Kate is again outrageous and an example of the criminalization of survivors, like you said. But I also think it speaks to a kind of common narrative that is a misconception, which is that outsiders perceive when there is a case of sexual violence being reported that the victim or the survivor is the person who will continue to push for justice and do anything at all costs to receive it. And in reality, the person who will do anything at all costs to make sure a case actually doesn't go somewhere is the perpetrator or is the person who is accused. And I think this is something that schools recognize and understand, but outsiders don't. And hey, 10 years after what happened, turning around in her school and saying, "You violated my Title IX rights," is unpredictable to schools. And so I think where they're coming in and coming from is needing to make an example of her to go back to that old pattern of they know if they push back against survivors hard enough, typically because the experience is so traumatic, because they just want the aftermath and the turmoil to end, usually, they know that they can push them until it does. And that's how I think I ended up on homebound ex education and instruction, how I ended up finishing eighth grade from home, is because they knew that my perpetrator would make so much more of a ruckus, of a fuss, would sue for defamation, would do all of these things that they knew I was too weak to do because I hadn't had any chance to heal. And so I think the message they're trying to send by turning back around on Kate when she turned on them later is that we need to bring survivors back down to this place where we can belittle and berate them enough that things go away and they go away permanently. Even if 10 years later, when you're grown, when you have a legal education, when you have the law behind you to stand on and a experience and an education that you didn't when you were young and vulnerable to all of their deceptive and manipulative tactics, that they can still silence you. And so it's not worth it for people to go through with it in the future. And I think that's the message that they're trying to send and to solidify, because it's really rare that somebody is able to kind of gather that strength years and years later and get a public case going and make an example of the school. And so they've decided to do the same to her.
Thank you so much for your insight on all of that, Ray. And these are just like a spot in the universe, like the examples of these kinds of cases that we hear about all the time, and then also the ones that we don't hear about. And speaking of cases that, of sexual assault that have gone viral, your video sharing your story about how your abuser assaulted and harassed you went viral. I wanted to ask you, where did you find the strength to not only share about what happened to you, but to continue on after the harassment? And also, how are you able to separate yourself from him while, he was harassing you? Like, are you able to share? Did he reach back out to you? How did you protect yourself, not just physically, but also emotionally during that time?
That's a great question. And I think I'll go chronologically. So I transferred high schools because the harassment was getting so severe and it was, even violent at times at my original high school. And so I transferred into a Maryland high school about a month into my junior year of high school. And so that was right before COVID hit. And I loved my new high school. It was far enough away that not everyone really knew everything about me. Some people had an idea, but they didn't really seem to care because it was such a small rumor that they had heard at that point, or very, very little amounts of information. So I love my new high school, but COVID hit really soon after I got there. And I was, returning to homebound instruction for the rest of high school. So, rest of junior year, all of senior year was online for me because I was in the DMV area, which was very, very strict about COVID regulations. I only went back for graduation. But during COVID, the month before senior year, or the month I might have been after senior year, my timeline of COVID is a little bit jumbled. People started to see these accounts pop up on Instagram across the DC, Maryland, Virginia area that were targeting high school perpetrators of sexual violence. And this is something that I don't think we've really seen before, in such strong numbers and with so much support. They instantly garnered, thousands of followers across the area. And they would post DMs that they got, redacting the names of the survivor that DM'd them while naming the perpetrator alongside a picture of the perpetrator, and the story. And they would tag the perpetrator. And we just saw this wave of support for survivors that I had never, ever even imagined could exist. And I felt like it was finally time for me to share my side of the experience, because for all of high school, my abuser was the one telling our story as he perceived it, or as he wanted people to perceive it, which is that I had lied, about everything. And I just didn't contradict what he was saying, because I didn't want to add fuel to the fire. I was scared of this person who had a knife. He was, again, very powerful. I just didn't want to escalate things. And I knew he was someone that reacted to escalation. But from the safety of behind a screen, not knowing when we would ever be out of our houses again, I think everyone collectively felt this new sense of power that was really beautiful, to experience. And I decided that it was time for me to share my side. And so I DM'd one of the accounts. It's called, I think, DC Safe Space. I don't even know if it still exists. But they posted, his picture with my story over it and with his full name on it. And he immediately posted on his Instagram story that, I needed to get a hobby, I needed to stop lying. But his girlfriend reached out to me, which was shocking to me. And she told me that she felt like nobody would keep up their side of the story for as long as I had if they were lying. And nobody would be doing the advocacy work that I was doing if I was lying. And she was struggling to reconcile that her boyfriend was in denial. And she told me she was going to talk to him about it. And I, struggle still with how to feel about that conversation, but I mostly feel positively about it. And a day later, he posted on his story, it was a very small, not legally probably binding apology, but it was something. And he said, I hurt you. I'm sorry I was mean to you. I'm sorry that I did things to you. I was convinced I didn't sexually assault you, but I will no longer be rejecting your side of the story. And again, a weak apology, but it was something. And I have that now. And it's really empowered me to speak out more publicly because I know he can no longer, utterly deny everything because he has admitted or conceded to something. Even if it might not be what I've accused him of, even if it might not be specific. And I'm really no longer scared of him in terms of his retaliation because, one, I know he was a child when it happened. I know that I think a lot of his retaliation was him channeling everything his mother was telling him to do. I think his abuse was him recreating what his father was doing to him at home. And, I'm still not fully empathetic. I still don't think he's not culpable for a lot of what happened, especially because we were aging as it was happening. Especially because a lot of the retaliation was still happening, when we were 17 and we were much more grown than when we were in middle school. But what I am more scared of is my school, because my school was always made up of the adults who knew what they were doing when they retaliated against me, versus I really like to believe he was a child who was an idiot, who was a bad person, yes, but was recreating behavior that he had observed as a child. And when adults retaliate in this devastating way, it's a lot more scary. And I chose to name my school in that the comment section of that TikTok that went viral or that Instagram reel that went viral. And that was the scariest thing that I've ever done. Talking about my story was scary at first, but I've never felt the need to name my abuser because what really, to me, demands a reckoning is my middle school. That's what reconciliation to me would look like, not the abuse, but the aftermath where my middle school subjected me to all of this re-victimization and abused me in their own way. So they are the people that I have had to, I think, overcome that fear of speaking out against. Because with my abuser, it was always just he was talking anyway. And me talking was just me reclaiming my story. With my middle school, it's like, what will they do to me now? And seeing that they're hiding comments on their Instagram page is scary to me. And I keep wondering, are they gonna reach out to me? Is their legal team gonna reach out to me? And can they really do anything? Because what I claimed in that video is something I have supported by email.
Well, first of all, I think it's amazing that your abuser's girlfriend actually reached out to you. And because you persisted, she not only reached out to you, but he actually reached out to you. And most survivors never receive that kind of, well, even though you say it's kind of a, I don't want to say a half-assed apology, but and but it is something, and it is some sort of awareness and moving that needle in the right direction towards some sort of justice. Not that any sort of justice, like something was stolen from you. Not that it can be fully, restored, but at least there was some sort of apology. And it just shows the impact you have by using your voice, Ray. And, going back to what you said about the scariest part are the adults being the ones that are trying to hide your story and silence you. It's really about silencing the victim. And as a and you're a child, that goes back to what we're seeing with the story of at the Rachel Carson Middle School, and just the adults in the room not being the adults. I think it says a lot about you that you have that strength, even as a child, to do what's right and empower yourself and make a difference. That gives me so much hope that, that strength lives within you. And I think that says a lot about being a survivor. We have to be these warriors that come out of this horrible situation when these things are something stolen from us, and we're reclaiming that by using our voice. So thank you so much for doing that. And you're really not just standing up for yourself, but standing up for survivors everywhere. And I know, Rich, earlier we had talked about sex education and the resources that you'd wish you'd had when all of this was happening. So I would like to ask you, what would you like to see change and improve when it comes to sex education in public schools? And, we could get into private schools, but I think specifically public schools is a good place to start. And how it pertains to sexual harassment and violence surrounding children. And so what do you think could be done differently and improved to help children in those situations?
Yeah, I think sex education is really where the answer to minimizing and ultimately, hopefully, stopping sexual violence will be rooted in, because all violence, for the most part, is because hurt people are hurting people, or people who don't understand something are engaging in sexual activity without any education about how it works. A lot of people go to college without even having any sort of sex education, and then they're navigating all of these alcohol-riddled environments where you're supposed to be having sex, but no one's told you how to have it. And that's not an excuse at all, but it's to say that the culture and that education can really have a vast impact on the ways that we engage and interact with each other. And that's really why I've gotten interested in legislative work for a future career, is because I really think law can influence culture in a way that we maybe don't give it credit for all of the time. And we've seen that with sex education laws in states, both negatively and positively. We see rolling back sex education laws, increasing rates of teen pregnancy versus reducing it with abstinence only. That's not actually working. But I think sex education can start very, very young. In terms of consent specifically, it starts in games of red light, green light. It starts in when somebody is having a tickling interaction in a classroom, stopping that and intervening and saying, she said stop. Just because she's laughing, or he or they are laughing, doesn't actually mean that they want it, because that's just a physical reaction to what you're doing. But they're saying no. If we ask permission for hugs with children instead of forcing them to hug people, when we give them that agency from a young age, they will feel empowered to take agency in other situations later. And the people who they're interacting with will also think twice about, oh, maybe I should be asking for hugs, if they watch that behavior modeled for them. And so to me, sex education, or just specifically in terms of consent, can be started in such small but significant and impactful ways at such young ages. And we should be talking about sex itself much younger, because kids know what it is, especially with the just completely unprecedented and unregulated internet access that people have now. They know what sex is. They are watching porn so young. The first time someone shoved porn in my face, I was in fifth grade. And that was when phones were still transitioning from BlackBerry to smartphone. That was like the first smartphone screen that you could search stuff on, I think was probably around when I was in fifth grade. And it was this kid in my class came up to me and showed me rough porn on his phone because it is so accessible. And I was, 11, but that was over 10 years ago. And so to imagine how young people are probably witnessing that by accident or intentionally or out of curiosity now, they are going to learn what sex is from porn if we don't tell them before they find it. And so we need to overcorrect. We need to get comfortable fast with talking with young children about what respect is, how respect applies throughout sexual experiences, because otherwise they're going to see people getting choked in sex without anybody asking about if they want to be choked. I know we've seen like a drastic increase in the acceptance and the approval of choking during sex without even asking for it. People just do it now, which is completely insane, but it's happening because it's all over porn websites and it's completely normalized. So we need to accept that children are going to learn sex wrong very young if we don't teach them it right. And so I don't know what the exact age is that we need to be doing it or how. I'm not a sex educator, but I think it needs to be early elementary school at the latest, because people will figure out what sex is in their own terms and in their own completely wrong way if we don't.
And I love that you bring up those points because we are in an age that is so internet driven, as you said, and it's just unprecedented waters, and it's a new, these are new things to navigate that, like our generation, I think we're only what, 7 years apart, Ray? And there's still so much, like the way the internet and technology has grown so quickly. Just shows that the government and, parents and the adults in the room, we should say, should be handling these things and addressing them. And I know that, there's, they're presenting legislation to make it so if you watch porn, you have to present your ID, which is supposed to be, to protect children. But in a lot of ways, it is also, as we know, part of Project 2025 to get rid of the porn industry in general, which kind of it obviously goes into free speech and all of these other different laws. So it's very complicated. But when it comes to protecting children, you would think that both. That would be a bipartisan issue. Unfortunately, it's not. And we're seeing how our government and us, certain people are protecting pedophiles and a lot of different a lot of different things that are happening. So we have to address these issues without the hypocrisy that we're seeing right now. So I really appreciate you sharing all that. And maybe there will be another time where we can have a conversation about sex education, a bigger conversation, and where we can go from here. So thank you again for sharing that, Ray. And I just had a final question for you. So this week was Bi Awareness Week, and you are openly bisexual, as am I. So I wanted to ask you about that. As someone who is bisexual, can you talk about, coming out, what it was like coming out, and how it has been being open about your sexuality in a world where bi erasure exists and it does exist in the LGBTQ plus community? So if you would be willing to speak on that, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
I love that question. I'm glad you brought that up. I think I had a really unique experience of queerness growing up, and just in terms of the coming out process. I think I was probably one of the tail end generations, at least of, children growing up in DC for the most part, which is such a liberal and accepting place where you had to even come out. I think maybe we're going back into a place where you might have to again. But I think I was probably, at least in the average household of DC, that was one of the kind of last generations where it felt so denormalized. But I luckily grew up in a household that didn't really define what a relationship should or should not look like for me. And at a very, very young age, I had queer impulses exclusively. So my parents thought I was a lesbian. until basically middle school. Because I would come home from school and I'd say, I'm in love with this girl, in my first grade class, or we kissed at a play date. And, I remember my mom, who's very, very accepting, she her initial reaction, because I think it was 2009 when I told her I kissed this girl in my class. So still before, gay marriage felt like it was going to be something that was widely possible at any point in time. I told her that I was in love with this girl, that I kissed her, and my mom like paused, and she, I think, had this like emotional slip where she was like, oh, your life is going to be so hard. And I now recognize it as, a slip up of sympathy and of her wanting me to have an easy, good life where no one would be against me or my relationships or my partners or what love looked like to me. But at that time was such a defining moment because I thought, oh, like who I care about, who I kiss, can make my life hard. And I really internalized that because I was like 7 years old. And I think I carried that kind of shame suddenly, which I don't blame my mom for at all. I think I would have felt it in any, I think anyone else would have made me feel that way at some point or another. I carried that with me into my school, and I was around people who didn't grow up around queer people, who didn't really understand queerness, who probably some of them are queer now, just statistically, which is also funny to me. But I just became, a slur to these people. Like they would just call me, homophobic slurs became my nickname all through most of elementary school, and then also part of middle school until I started dating this guy, and people thought, oh, it was just a phase, and that goes into the bi erasure. She's actually straight, like she was just saying she was gay. But it was really difficult to feel so rejected for something that felt so intrinsic to who I was from such a young age, especially after recognizing, I think, a part of myself that was so important at such a young age, which I think is a rare experience to be able to articulate it at a young age, because my mom, helped me give me the words to articulate what my sexuality was kind of starting to look like or to be without telling me who to be. And she was really supportive of me, dressing, I guess it, in that time she would call it tomboyish, but just shopping for whatever, gender fluid type of clothes I felt comfortable in at that time, and experimenting with gender, experimenting with self-expression. My mom was so supportive of that, but at school, the environment was so unsupportive and so homophobic, and I think, vaguely transphobic too, just in terms of me dressing in a way that they didn't think was feminine presenting. They let that kind of be expressed in a transphobic way, not sure of how I was expressing my sexuality or my identity. And it was difficult. And in college, even at Temple, which is, in a really progressive city, Philly, and a really progressive college, Temple, I felt like the queer organizations on campus didn't feel like a place that wanted me as a bisexual person. And even at graduation, we have this amazing event called Lavender Graduation, which is, to celebrate queer students, to celebrate trans students. And we get a lavender cord, and we have a really empowering advocacy in the queer space speaker come and give the commencement speech. I remember hearing people who were lined up before we were going to walk across the stage saying, all right, like, let's figure out who here we think is actually just queer baiting. And they would just point at everyone who I knew was bisexual or pansexual or just fluid in their sexuality. And I just still think that people really strongly think you have to appear a certain way to be attracted a certain way. And I really have never felt like I found a home in the queer community because of that. And I think I've just been around the wrong groups. I don't think that they're all like that, but I have never been around a, queer community that has felt accepting of bisexual people entirely. And it's been really frustrating.
And I'll say too, I really relate to that, Ray. And it wasn't till meeting Zachary and our other co-founders in Rise Above Justice movement that I also felt accepted for being bisexual, because I have faced the same things. I didn't come out till later in life, or like, I'm 30, so I'm not old, but I didn't come out till like, a few years ago. And I think, there's a really strong queer community here in Nashville of musicians, and I'm not saying that they don't accept me, but I'm also like, I'm not exactly getting invited to everything, right? So I think some people think because I am in a straight presenting relationship that I am not like the same thing, like you're saying, queer baiting and not really who I am, or it's like very like you have to be one way or another. So I think that's such an important thing to say, because as we're seeing with the Stonewall Monument, obviously, it's so unfortunate and so tragic that they took off trans people, but I just saw they took off bisexual people, and it's like, it's hard to identify with something that you just are like, I know this is who I am. But I know that a lot of people, even in the community, who are supposed to be accepting and uplifting me, because we're all on the same side, right? We're all fighting for the same things, don't really want to accept you. So thank you for sharing that, because if there's other bisexual people listening right now, I'll, again, don't want them to feel alone. The same thing with survivors. So thank you, Ray. Thank you for that.
And I say this as a bisexual survivor myself as well. This has turned into like a bi pride moment for a second. But I say this as, a bisexual person. I've had a very difficult journey. I went through conversion therapy for 2.5 years after being sexually assaulted at 17. And I want to add an emphasis on that I was not forced into it by my parents. My mom has always been very accepting of me, but society forced me to believe that I needed to change myself. And while I haven't, I've shared my story like numerous times, I haven't shared a whole lot of it, but there will be something that'll be coming out later on in the next couple months that I have been asked to be a part of, and I'll share more about that later. But Gwen, you hit it absolutely, and Ray, you also do as well with the bi erasure within the LGBTQ plus community. And I'm still trying to find my place, and I don't fit in over here. I don't fit over there. And it reminds me of being in like high school. Like you have the jocks over here, you have your theater kids, you have your choir kids, you have your geeks, and you have like all these different groups, and you're trying to figure out where you fit in, where you find your place. But I want to highlight that you received the prestigious 2024 Truman Scholarship. And you became number six at Temple University. So, first of all, I want to say that is absolutely incredible. And you're getting ready to write a certain project. So, would you like to talk about that?
Yes, thank you for the congratulations as well. And thank you for sharing both of your stories just throughout this call. Also, I just want to acknowledge them because they've been really moving on my end too. But I have started the process of writing a memoir because of a lot of the things that I've talked about today. But because my school has always told their own story, because my abuser has always told his own story for so long, I just feel like mine can't be complete in a Instagram reel, in a TikTok, as much as I like making those for awareness purposes. I feel like it all needs to be laid out in one place, especially because I, in 2023, got a call from two parents who were parents of kids at that school, at Lowell School, where their children were intimidated and retaliated against in very similar ways to me by the same head of middle school. And I was just so reinvigorated and outraged to know that little children, like 13, is so much younger than I think people are trying to present it as in media today, and 13-year-olds want to be perceived as, because I think they really want to be perceived as grown-ups, or as, 16-year-olds. It's just the threshold for how you present is just getting lower and lower and lower. But it was so horrifying to hear that it wasn't just like this one-off experience where they just were figuring out how to start a school and they really, really deeply messed up with me. I think they were learning how to be middle school administrators, learning how to navigate those situations with me, and they solidified it as protocol for future people. And knowing that makes me feel like the only way to dismantle it and to hold them accountable outside of a courtroom, which is something I'm just not open to pursuing, because I just know too much about the justice system and how it turns on people and how horrifying and expensive it is. I need to get it out all on paper, and I need to hold them accountable in the way that feels right to me, and that's by sharing the truth.
You know, they always say the truth shall set you free. And
Exactly.
by getting your story out there, you know, which obviously, you know, you have an open invite to be on this podcast anytime. You also have an open invite to collaborate with us anytime because we believe in voices like yours. We believe in voices like other survivors who may be listening and feeling like they're less alone just by you being a visible voice. And I know your memoir and the work that you have coming up is going to be deeply incredible, and I'm really excited, you know, to continue collaborating with you. And you know, again, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. You have an open invite anytime you would like to, and especially as you continue to grow as a leader in the survivor community. And you know, I look up to you in a lot of different ways because if I would have had the courage to do what you were doing now. You know, Gwen is 30 years old. I'm 29. My partner's 27. But if I would have had that courage whenever I was younger, I think about oftentimes what my life would look like right now. And I, you know, Gwen, you mentioned earlier about like MySpace and you mentioned about like Facebook. And yes, I've had my Facebook since 2011. Which I just entered high school. I was 14 years old. So I've had it, you know, ever since. And I've built like a community there. But at the same time, I'm also at the age where I start recognizing that people that I went to school with have started to pass away. So some of those people that are on that account, they have actually passed away, either due to, you know, domestic violence, gun violence, or suicide. And it's a very real, you know, thing. The older you get, people start to, you know, leave your life in various ways. And my best friend was shot and killed last year, and that is something that I live with, you know, every single day. Because she was the first person that I told about being sexually assaulted. She's the first person that I told about, you know, going through what I was going through. She's the first person I came out to before even coming out to my mom. You know, she helped me through a lot of my journey. And that's, you know, I want to recognize that. And I want to recognize that whenever I created this movement, it wasn't for me. It wasn't for me. And did I imagine that the movement would ever turn into what it's turned into now? No, I did not. I did not envision it. I did not see it. But now that I am, I'm seeing what it's doing. It's bringing people together. It's bringing, you know, survivors forward that have never shared their stories before, but they feel empowered because of the movement that Gwen has helped me with, and Mercedes and Amelia and, you know, Ray. You've also helped us build our platform. You've inspired us. You keep us going. And that younger energy is what our communities really need to continue overcoming these obstacles in a society where it says you have to fit into this box or you're seen as less than. So, Ray, with that, is there anything else you would like to talk about? And then I have one more question after that.
I think I'd just like to go off what you said. Just thank you again for being vulnerable with the things that you shared, but also for thanking, you know, all the people in your life and on your team who made it successful and who gave you strength. I feel like I need to do the same thing. Like I wouldn't have had any of that strength or of that courage. I was, I think to say I was weak is, minimizing, but I was weak in the beginning. I was a child who was really devastated and really struggling and couldn't get out of bed most days when I was learning online. But I encountered media that talked about sexual violence. Like the first book I read that was about sexual assault, and I hated reading before I was assaulted, was Chessie Proud's I Have the Right To book about being sexually assaulted at St. Paul's boarding school and about the institutional betrayal there and about how the community rallied around her perpetrator. And that was when I started to feel kind of an ounce of I have to get up and I have to keep moving through the day because these voices kind of carried me through the hallways of school and they carried me through the hardest, most challenging period of my life. And I think that's what you're doing, but in such a huge way, because Chessie's book was like one of the first things that was there and accessible. And now there is so much out there, including her book and including your platform, which reaches, hundreds of thousands of people. And I think what you do every day is give people that strength that people found in pages and still do. But I don't think we can attribute that courage or that strength to just one person ever, because, like you said, it's like this chorus of people that are upholding each other and supporting them through the healing process that they've been through. And even though that burden is so unfair to put on survivors themselves, we still carry each other through that marathon of healing that is so long and drawn out. And so I just wanted to say that your platform is doing that now for so many people who need to hear that they're not alone. I bet you people feel like they're not now in a way that they might not have 20 years ago.
Thank you for that. I greatly appreciate that. That means the entire world to me. And that brings me to my last question for you. And the last question is, if you were to receive a DM today, and it was somebody who, and I want to be frank, we receive these practically every day about being connected to resources and, survivors, they want to share their story. But if somebody was to DM you today and you happen to check your message request, which as a survivor on a public platform, checking your message request can be a very daunting thing. Gwen knows this. I know that. I'm sure you know that. And a lot of others can definitely attest to that. But again, if somebody was to DM you and you were checking your message request and somebody asked you, I was just sexually assaulted. What can I do to heal? What would you tell them? Because this is at the very beginning of their journey. They recognize, they ask. Now, what is that next step? What would you recommend to them? And what would you tell them?
I think before getting into, resources or anything like that, I would tell them to not have a narrow depth or tunnel vision of what justice is going to look like for them. Because I think that can be one of the most harmful things in a healing and recovery journey for a survivor, is right off the bat having this vision of this kind of unfortunately probably unattainable vision of justice where somebody's held accountable fully, where you get that apology that's perfect, where you get even a slight apology from that person. I would tell them to keep an open mind and allow their vision to, keep evolving, because I found that to be one of the most harmful things for me, was ex having expectations and having this vision of, someday he's going to come to his senses and he's going to admit everything publicly, and then every person in my life is going to apologize. The school is going to say sorry. The school is going to be held accountable by the parents. The parents will rally around me. And none of that happened. Eventually, I got that half-assed apology, like you put it, when that's how I refer to it typically. But it wasn't perfect. It wasn't what I imagined. And my narrow vision of justice is what kept me from starting to heal years before I could have, because if I had, in he took this graduation from me in 8th grade, and that was so upsetting. It was this thing I'd looked forward to since I was 2. And in high school, when he ended up at the same school as me, I was immediately the first thing that I thought when I saw him, other than, oh my God, he goes to the same school, is I'm gonna walk across that stage and there is nothing that he can do to stop me this time. But in the process of me being at that school for the, 2 years and 1 month that I was there, I was miserable and re-traumatized and re-victimized just every single day. And if I had had the courage to visualize justice differently than when I was 14 years old versus 16 versus 15 and let it keep evolving, I might have been a lot more okay than if I came to the conclusion when I was, 17 years old that I needed to be at a different school and I couldn't take it anymore. And so I would tell them to have an open mind that things are going to change, your feelings are going to change about things, and that's okay. And every feeling that you have is valid, and everything you want to do is valid, but just allow yourself to have the option to think differently the next day. If you sleep on something, if it changes, if you have a revelation, that's okay, because everything that you do for you is going to be the best thing as long as you allow yourself to do that thing. Because if you stick to this narrow timeline and this narrow path, you might end up hurting yourself more.
Great. Thank you again for joining myself and joining Gwen on the Rise of Justice Movement podcast. Gwen, is there anything else you would like to ask Ray or say to Ray at all?
Well, Ray, thank you so much, and I'm really grateful and just honored to talk to you. And I know we've been collaborating, so it's nice. It's just so nice to put the story behind the face and the name, because I think it's so important that people get to learn who you are, not just as a survivor, but who is Ray Epstein. And that's the beauty of the podcast that Zachary's created. And I'm just thank you so much for all the work you're doing, and I cannot wait to see where this all leads for you. So just keep doing what you're doing and staying strong, and we're here for you, and just knowing you're not alone.
Thank you so much for having me. It really means the world. I am so blown away by both of you and look up to you both so much. So it's really surreal.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ray. You have an open invite anytime you would like to come back on the Movements podcast. Thank you for being my biggest inspiration and keeping me going. And with that, to anybody out there, please find Ray Epstein on social media, uplift her work, uplift her voice, believe survivors, and continue to uplift our movement. We are on social media at Rise Above Justice Movement. And with that, stay tuned for the next conversation. Thank you.